This is Monocle on Design. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
If a chair could talk, that could be quite a dangerous thing. And what would the chair say about what you were thinking? Because we think about so much on a chair, like negative, positive, you know, happy thoughts, sad thoughts, whatever it is, we do it on a chair.
We meet Yinka Ilori, a London-based industrial designer whose brightly coloured furniture takes inspiration from his Nigerian roots. Plus...
It's important to understand what the design intent was, but also how we want to use it and whether we can find a really happy coming together of the two. So it might mean preserving something and adapting our way of life, or it might mean adapting the building.
We ask a preservationist about the cost of keeping old but important buildings in good nick and run through a few headlines with a design writer. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Now, chairs occupy a strange, let's say uncomfortable position in the history of design. Although many of us simply sit on them to ponder, many an architect and designer has devoted unimaginable effort and research into paring back and perfecting these everyday objects. They needn't have bothered, or so says London-based furniture designer Yinka Ilori, whose own work riffs on both his Nigerian heritage, but also plays with colours, textures, and even the idea that imperfection itself can be a blessing. As well as his furniture business, Yinka also teamed up with Priscor Architects to design the winning entry for the Dulwich Picture Gallery Pavilion, and he joined me in studio to talk business, sitting pretty in the furniture game, and designing sustainably.
For me, what I loved about chairs, first it starts from my household, my parents' household in North London, and how my dad would come back from work and he would have this chair he would always sit on. So without even speaking to him, we knew that okay, dad's home, this is dad's chair, got to get a dad's chair. My dad's a retail manager, commercial, and he worked in different kind of companies. So he would do an 8-hour shift, 7 in the morning, come back from work, and then he comes in and you're like, oh, dad's home. And you just get the look. You're like, he wants his chair. And you just get out of the chair.
So what are we talking, like a cantilever, like Bauhaus chair? Are we talking like
a lean back? A chair from like Dorsten Market, nothing fancy, you know, but it's comfortable. You know, we love it. It's just his chair. I think for me, it's just, as humans, we always have a chair we're attached to. If we look at chairs, you know, chairs hold so much feelings and emotions and tell stories. And I think as people, we sometimes take those chairs for granted because we just think, oh, it's just a chair. It's going to keep us comfortable. But we trust that chair to kind of hold our feelings, emotions and hold our stories. And for me, I always thought, you know, if a chair could talk, that could be quite a dangerous thing. And, what would the chair say about what you were thinking? Because we think about so much on a chair, like negative, positive, you know, happy thoughts, sad thoughts, whatever it is, we do it on a chair, you know, and no one knows. It's a little kind of personal secret between you and a chair that no one knows. I find that quite fascinating.
I love that. And you can definitely see the mood to like the lots of classic chairs. If you're looking at a kind of Pantone chair, you can tell there was a funny mood going on.
Yeah,
exactly. At the time. And you could tell he fell off it a lot because in my opinion, it's very poorly designed. But one other way in which chairs can affect your mood and something that is just so important, I think, to your work, you can tell me if I'm wrong, is the idea of colour. Architects and sometimes industrial designers, they think that something classy or something expensive shouldn't be colourful. Your narrative goes very much against that. Why is that?
I don't know. I think for me, again, it has to do with my background and just sort of seeing how my parents, you know, sort of wore colour to church, to weddings, you know, coronations, and how it made them feel really happy and proud of their culture. And it's really, for me, interesting how colour, which is, for me, people might think it's really simple, but it's such a quite a powerful thing to kind of wear or to draw or whatever it's been. So I think for me, just having colour in furniture and how you wear it, I think it's quite interesting. So I wanted to try and incorporate it into my work and sort of celebrate my culture, you know, through colour. And that was the best medium for me because I was always quite shy of wearing my Nigerian clothes because I thought people would laugh or stare at me, and they did that. I saw people laugh at my parents. Oh, why is he wearing that colourful hat or that, you know, weird jacquard or weird lace? But it was so expensive. But they loved wearing it because it shouted out they were Nigerian and they loved colour and they were proud. So I wanted to take elements of those themes and put them into a chair.
Another aspect of your work is confronting this idea that we're all going to have to face up to soon, which is the idea of waste, of overusing things. And I think, ironically, you know, industrial designers end up flying around the world to trade shows to exhibit things on temporary stands that end up getting chucked away with no future use. Your work's a bit of a statement about that, whether it's upcycling or whether it's about using materials. How did that become so informative of your practice?
It all started off, I did a project in uni called Our Chair. And it was basically a brief set by Jane Atfield. Jane Atfield's also, you know, an amazing designer. She was my tutor at the time. So it was also inspired by Matuna Gampa, who did this project called 100 Chairs, 100 Days. which was for me like really pivotal to my career, because it really inspired me to, wow, like this is a project based on 100 chairs and it's all been, they're all found objects. So I think for me, just the power of having an old piece of furniture and retelling its narrative, but also you're, you know, you're doing your bit by, you know, reloving furniture and recycling. So that's how I kind of fell in love with the whole concept of, you know, of reloving. And I kind of hate the word upcycling, so I'm trying to use reloving, because, you know, I'm giving an old bit of furniture a new life and reloving and telling it, giving it a new story. So yeah, that's how it started for me. And then it became my career. So I became known as the chairman.
You're definitely the chairman of your company, which I like. Yeah. There's this other idea that I think is a little bit deeper as well, though, that industrial design, you know, if you looked around an Alessi showroom or something, you wouldn't realise that industrial design always has the capacity to be, say, provocative or to be fun or to ask questions. Mm. But how do you get that level of meaning into something which people don't always look at and think, wow, I'm searching this chair for meaning, I'm searching this table for meaning. How do you make these things provocative and humorous, or does that just come out through the creative process?
It does, yeah. But one thing I found I struggled with at university was that basically you always had to kind of have a brief. You had a brief and you sketched your idea. And I always hated that process of sort of sketching something and then that's the end piece, that's the end product. I enjoy making mistakes, and I've always found my mistakes are what makes my piece so powerful and most kind of thought-provoking. So I always work the reverse. What I try and do is I try and create furniture that's really not perfect, because I think people always like things that are perfect, but those imperfections are what gives it character and personality and tells such a strong story and allows people to, you know, connect with that piece of furniture. So when I go to like trade shows every year, like during the design week, I always see the same chair every year. It's just, for me, really boring. There's nothing I can connect to. There's no narrative. There's no feeling. Furniture for me is, it's about emotion. You know, you want to feel you can connect to something and just feel like there's something you can relate to. I create work that's really humorous. And I think what's nice about what I do is that the first thing you see when you look at my chair is that you smile. And that's, for me, that's so powerful. The idea that colour and the idea that a chair that's not functional and looks a bit weird makes you smile. People find comfort in the most weirdest of positions, but comfort is quite, for me, is an acquired taste. It's up to the individual how they define comfort, you know, or perfection.
Yeah, and I think giving people the freedom to use things as they would use them, not prescribing how, say, someone should sit.
Exactly.
Is super important. But we're sitting here in London.
Yep.
We've talked about your Nigerian heritage. How much of the new project that you're working on at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, which maybe you could tell us a little bit about, is about celebrating the fact that you have Nigerian heritage, but you're in London, which is, at its best, an amazing cosmopolitan melting pot of different cultures and of being permissive to people expressing themselves. What is the new project about, and what were you trying to do with this statement?
As we know, Dulwich is an interesting area. I really go to Dulwich. But it kind of happened in such quite an organic way. So, you know, Price Gore, you know, architects based in Peckham, and they designed my new studio in Harrow Milestone. So it's, you know, I think like 12 artist studios, and then came down to my studio and was like, oh, can we come and take photos for our portfolio? And then they left the studio and was like, oh, you know, we found your studio quite inspiring. Can we do some sort of collaboration? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, oh, we're pitching, you know, for the Dulwich Picture Gallery. This is what we're thinking, and, you know, we want to create a mini Lagos, you know, in Dulwich. And I was like, this sounds amazing. Yeah, let's do it. And then it just, you know, it started from there. So I was, you know, back and forth with sketches and mood boards and proposals and ideas back and forth, and, you know, sort of learning how architects think as well, and sort of what's their kind of process, and again, sharing my ideas with them. So it was such a nice organic, you know, process, which for me is always the best way of working. What we want to try and do is I think for me, I see the colour palette as a celebration for London's multiculturalism. One thing I love about being here is that London is so acceptance of so much culture, whether it's Ghanaian, Nigerian, whether it's, you know, Moroccan, whatever it is, it works really well. And that's what I love about being here. So we want to try and bring, you know, that kind of mini Lagos into Dulwich, and it will be through like things like food, performances. I mean, I'm really looking forward to kind of curating the programme for the Colour Palace during the 6 months. So I think it's going to be such an exciting project here, and I actually can't wait for it to kind of start being built, yeah.
So I think one of the interesting features about the Colour Palace, which you alluded to there, is that it's theatrical, that it's interactive. You know, how much should designers who, you know, sometimes work on objects that are inanimate, objects that stay still, how much should we be thinking about design as being something that can influence people's mood, that it can also be about what's consumed there, what's eaten, the music that's playing. Was that an interesting thing for you as a designer that works with materials to actually move into the architectural realm, to move into space, sound and taste?
Yeah.
And was that a challenge?
That was a challenge, yeah. But for me also quite exciting because it's really weird. I remember I was going to study architecture before I studied furniture and product design. So, and also I got quite bored of just designing chairs. And I want to actually, it's great to design a chair, but where will the chair go? That environment, the space it's in. Because that also kind of helps the narrative that I create and that chair is in the context. For me, that's the kind of direction I want to go into, I think, in the next kind of 3 or 4 years, 5 years, and do more architectural projects. I'm also doing actually another project, which is more of an architectural project, but I can't say much about it yet. But yeah, that is definitely what I want to be doing more of. It's quite an exciting process, curating events and kind of looking at the furniture that's in the space and, you know, lighting. So I'm looking forward to all kind of packaging process.
That was London-based furniture designer Yinka Ilori speaking to me a little earlier. Now, column inches are normally eaten up by new projects or envelope-pushing architectural plans, and preserving older buildings can be an often ignored labour. Preservation can also be political, approaching the tricky topic of what to maintain, adapt or abandon to history. As Monocle's Ben Rylan explains, though, sometimes it's worth looking backwards before steaming ahead.
When we talk about preservation, we're often referring to buildings that we might not use every day. The argument for maintaining a grand old majestic theatre, for instance, is quite different to, say, a car park or a train station that we're forced to use several times every day, even if it's no longer fit for purpose. Preservation as an emotional ideal is one thing, but good design is always practical design. So, practically speaking, when we preserve buildings, what are we really trying to preserve?
Really, what we're trying to do, I think, when we look after iconic buildings or historic buildings, is to try and understand what is important, what's special about them, and preserve that. So it might be that they have a fantastic facade on the street, or it might be that they have beautiful internal rooms, or it might be that they just have good spaces where we like to meet and that we want to preserve those sorts of spaces rather than an individual piece of architecture. So it can really differ from building to building.
That's Cordula Zeidler, a consultant from the historic buildings team at Donald Insull and Associates here in London. She says that there are some key differences to consider when comparing cases of preservation stemming from a building's historical value as opposed to its modern practicality.
That question is posed every single day in London because London is such a historic city. So you can ask that question for the House of Parliament, but for anything that's a listed building, really. So it can be quite challenging to figure out how to adapt a building so that we can live in it today, but that we also preserve what's special about it. So it's important to understand what the design intent was, but also how we want to use it and whether we can find a really happy coming together of the two. So it might mean preserving something and adapting our way of life, or it might mean adapting the building and taking something out, maybe recording it, maybe taking some beautiful photographs if we can't hang on to it, and trying to preserve at least a memory of it. I think there are loads and loads of interesting debates about this going on, and there isn't a one-fits-all solution at all.
There are few collisions between practicality and historical value that have proven quite as consequential as the case of New York's Pennsylvania Station. In an issue of the New Yorker magazine from 1958, critic Lewis Mumford wrote of his most recent visit to the station, a grand Romanesque structure in Midtown Manhattan. "No one now entering Pennsylvania Station for the first time could, without clairvoyance, imagine how good it used to be," he wrote. "In comparison to the almost indescribable botch that has now been made of it.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too."
Penn Station was, by the late 1950s, a pale shade of its former self. The pink granite walls had turned grey. The large murals by artist Jules Guérin had long been obscured by several years' worth of smog and filth. and a scattering of modern additions, such as a clamshell-shaped ticket counter suspended from one of the columns at a cost of $2 million, had only confused the original design and served to accentuate just how poor the station's overall maintenance had become. In a decade obsessed with modernity, the argument for preserving the 9-acre architectural behemoth, which dated back to 1910, was taken up by a vocal few. Members of the Action Group for Better Architecture in New York organized protests outside the station, carrying placards calling for action, not apathy. In the end, however, they couldn't stand in the way of what the prevailing view of the time saw as progress. In October 1963, demolition began. Gather dear in Childs.
Sometimes you just have to say the function the building was built for no longer is suitable for that building, and sometimes it's time to say goodbye and allow a building to regain a new lease of life. So a lot of government buildings at the moment in London and elsewhere are being reimagined and reused for completely different uses, some for residential, some as hotels, and that can work really well. And then those original functions move into a purpose-built building. And sometimes that's the happiest way to proceed. But sometimes we're so attached both to the building and the function in it, that I think we're prepared to make a compromise, but also enjoy the building for what it is. And it may not have the most up-to-date technical things we could expect in a new building, but it just lifts the spirit to enter into the building. And, you know, sometimes that's special enough to make a compromise.
Compromise was exactly what the powers behind the old Penn Station were trying to convince passengers was not synonymous with rail travel. Trains could be as modern as planes. In chasing progress, however, the planners of New York lost something far more important and irreplaceable. They robbed a city of a piece of itself. Lewis Mumford foresaw the deep cuts being inflicted on his city long before contemporary views caught up. He linked the era's distaste for heritage and preservation with a growing reliance on technology, a hungry beast of progress that threatened to roll on without reason or purpose. Unchecked, he feared that such short-sighted attitudes would one day create what he described as a uniform, all-enveloping superplanetary structure designed for automatic operation. Eventually, Mumford's prescient views were vindicated. He championed greater urban planning for people, not cars, extinguishing anyone who dared promote the then progressive plans for more highways in New York. The great robbery of Penn Station also left a wound so deep in the psyche of New Yorkers that it eventually led to the creation of the Landmarks Preservation Commission and saved Grand Central Terminal from a similar fate. Internationally, in the decades since, attitudes towards preservation have sharpened too.
Recently, we've seen some buildings being listed in London that wouldn't have been listed, I believe, 10 or 20 years ago, and that would have been lost. And sometimes these are more modest buildings architecturally, such as the Market Building in Brixton, for example, or the big recreation centre. They're big modern buildings, and not all of them are necessarily beautiful, but they mean something to us. And they mean something to some groups in society that previously didn't have a say. So it's very interesting to see that Brixton Market, which is home to a big immigrant community, has now been recognised as being a nationally significant building. So that would have gone had we not, as a society, decided that we are sort of a varied group of people and all of our views count. So I think that's very interesting that we're now looking at buildings quite differently. On the other hand, we've lost some really interesting buildings, and there's been a lot of debate about Robin Hood Gardens, which is a big brutalist concrete building in East London. Architects love it, but a lot of people hate it. They say, you know, it's very grim, it's made out of concrete, let's build something better. And I think you'll never get those two sets of people to agree. And a lot of people grieve for it, and a lot of people are very happy that it's going. So there's no one answer fits all.
As a society, we may not always be reading from the same page of history when it comes to choosing which buildings we preserve. What's most important, though, is that we pay attention to our architecture. Preservation isn't about nostalgia. It's about understanding where we came from, who we are, and how we got here. Because if we don't understand that, then how will we ever know where we're going next? For Monocle, I'm Ben Ryland.
Thanks to Ben Ryland there, speaking to Cordula Zeidler, who is a consultant in the Historic Buildings team at conservation practice Donald Insull Associates. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now in studio by the architecture writer, critic and author, Christopher Beanland. Christopher, welcome to Monocle on Design. I don't think you've been a guest with us before, although you and I have met in the Monocle offices.
We have indeed, Josh, yes. But thank you for having me on today.
It's really my pleasure and thank you for coming in. So we've got a bit of a handful. We're travelling from Berlin. We're even going to Birmingham, a rarity for Monocle, yes, on today's roundup. And then we'll probably end up in the south of France like most good holidays. Why don't we start off in Berlin? Because there is a design headline, a building in particular, that has caught your eye. Tell us a little bit about why.
One of my favourite Berlin buildings is the Beer Pincel, which translates as the Beer Brush. It does look somewhat like a toilet brush, if we're going to be candid.
What on earth is a beer brush when it's at home?
I've always wondered this. I think it's because it looks like a brush and beer is served in it. So I think it's a kind of contraction of the two.
The Germans are very good for that. You've got a very long word that means something very specific.
This is my favourite thing about German, when you have lots of words strung together. I think it works very well as a language like that, definitely.
And the building itself, does it work well?
Well, this is a building that has had quite a colourful history, which is probably quite apt because at the moment it is very colourful to look at. So this is a building that was built in the 1970s by a couple. They were the Schulers, and it was designed originally as a bar, restaurant and nightclub. So in swinging 70s Berlin, when David Bowie was around, and later Nick Cave and all those kind of people, this was the place that you could come and have a good time. The building is kind of odd in so many ways. It's perched over an autobahn flyover. So it's very much got that feel of the age. You can imagine maybe Wim Wenders shooting a scene where a car drives past in black and white. Since it was built, it's been through these various incarnations. And a lot has been kind of happening at the Beer Pincel recently. So it was, well, vacant really since 2006. They've been trying to find a new use for it. Last year, it was on the market for a cool €3 million with Christie's. But unfortunately, they couldn't find a buyer for the building. So they're kind of readdressing what's going to happen to it. People say it should be considered as a landmark, which I think I agree with. It's, you know, a very famous structure in Berlin. Berliners know about it. Tourists go and see it.
Is this part of a slightly modish reappraisal of wacky mid-century buildings that we're all going through? Or is there a use to keeping this building? Are people attached to it because it's emblematic, as you said, of this kind of filmic bygone age of creating oddities? Or is there some other kind of use to this building? So, or is it pure sentiment?
We are very fond of those wacky buildings, aren't we, Josh? I think you're completely right on that. And if you look at some of the other buildings in Berlin that have been maybe not as loved as they could have been for a lot of years, they've been restored. There's a church called St. Agnes Church, which was turned into the Koenigs Gallery by a very famous New York gallerist who built himself his own apartment in the gallery. You can see photos of it online. It has not only purple carpets, but also purple carpeted walls and ceilings.
Sounds hideous.
It sounds and looks like Prince could live in that building. And I think a lot of people were maybe thinking that the Beer Pincel could be the same, that you could maybe turn it into a luxury residence. I think there are issues with what you can use the building for. It may have to stay as a bar and a club, which is probably why there were some issues with selling it. But it's certainly an important landmark. It also used to be red. A lot of Berliners think it should be repainted red from its kind of, well, wacky, shall we say, colour scheme at the moment. But, you know, it's something that is a part of the fabric of Berlin, and certainly would be a shame if we were to lose it, I think.
I think it's interesting for me because Berlin is obviously synonymous with a heady late-night rave scene. And as our cities become more expensive and we live closer together, actually, the residents are kind of winning in the battle against noise. So I say, keep the beer brush fun, brush up its uses, perhaps, and keep the beer flowing within it. So next up, we head to Birmingham. You're going to need to convince me on why this is a why this is a good architectural story. Not that I have anything against Birmingham, but because I think you know a lot more about it than I do.
I am guilty as charged in that respect. I lived in Birmingham for a few years. I think it's not featured in the pages of Monocle very often that I've seen.
No, but this is consider this your on-air pitching process.
Okay, so let's think about how we can make Birmingham more interesting. And there's a photographer in Birmingham, Philip Singleton, who has this exhibition, which is called Birmingham Dust. What he's really trying to do, I guess, is re-examine the architecture of the city using photography. So we're also aware of how architectural photography can look. Wide shots of buildings, very spectacular and dramatic.
Looks beautiful, don't want to walk there.
Exactly right, there's never anyone in the plaza. Now what Philip Singleton has tried to do is to capture the more human dynamic aspects of a building. So he's gone to these buildings. A lot of them are scheduled for demolition. And he's been given the time and the space to explore the buildings. And what he's found is the kind of relics of life there. So the magazines that people read and left in a drawer, or the empty coffee cups, posters on the wall. And he's really tried to capture that in this series of photos. And there's also video as well. I think why it's important for us to consider now and why it's newsworthy is that Birmingham is going through a period of intense change. We all know the city from the kind of crossroads era in the 70s, the wobbly sets and the concrete car parks and things. The city was rebuilt really en masse after the war in that very distinctive style. And that, even though it's popular with a lot of people, it's not popular with the city fathers in Birmingham, who basically want to create a more modern looking city. So they're demolishing a lot of those 60s buildings, 70s buildings, building more of the glass skyscrapers that we're familiar with today.
Well, there's a few narratives, aren't there? Because I guess in the late 19th and early 20th century, actually quite a lot of beautiful old buildings went up in Birmingham that were rather gorgeous. But you're right that today it might be better known for shopping arcades and like a very kind of samey look. But you know, you do hear statistics. We had a former foreign editor here at Monocle who was from Birmingham, who once claimed to me that it has more canals than Venice. So there are other aspects to Birmingham, obviously. Yeah. My special thanks to Christopher Beanland. He's an architecture writer, he's a journalist, he's an author, and he's just been in the studio. Thank you, Christopher.
Thanks, Josh.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Next week,
I don't think there is a particular one thing that all women have brought to creative industries, but I do identify an approach to design amongst my peer group, and that is to move beyond, I guess, the monocultures established in the 20th century where we were designing for industry.
We examine the work, role, and rightful place of a few long-overlooked female designers from the past century. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-themed inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and receive our sister podcast, available each Thursday. You'd also do well to pick up a copy of the Monocle Summer Weekly, which is available each Thursday through August, or, if that's not enough, the September issue of Monocle magazine. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis, researched by Anna Svetska, and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.